Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Byron Scott. In this evening's show, we're going to discuss the major news event in the continuing global war on terrorism from this past week. The siege of the cultural theater in Moscow held by Chechenian terrorists and rebels, which began last Wednesday evening and ended in the early mornings of Saturday, with the death of more than 100 persons. We're going to discuss the fallout for the media coverage of terrorism from this event and the continuing war in Chechnya. Our guests this evening are from 60 Minutes in Tbilisi, Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, Akaki Gokakishvili, anchor and producer of that show. Hello, Akaki. And again, I apologize in advance for mispronouncing your name. Our second guest is Betsy Pisek, the United Nations correspondent for the Washington Times, talking to us, I believe, from New York.
Correct. Good morning.
Good morning. Alexander Mekushev, the producer of Associated Press Television, speaking to us from Moscow. Hello, Alexander.
Hello.
And finally, Andrei Zolotov, a reporter for the Moscow Times, also in Moscow. Hello, Andrei.
Hello. Hello, Scotty.
Yes. I want to first welcome all of you to the show and apologize that the regular host, Stuart Lurie, is in Lima, Peru this week at the sessions of the Inter-American Press Association. However, I am delighted to be talking to all of you. I've been following this story closely as it happened. I was in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia this past week. I'm still suffering badly from jet lag, but I was watching particularly the wall-to-wall Russian television coverage of this crisis. And Andrei, I wanted to start with you and refer to an article that you had in the Moscow Times 2 days ago saying television coverage comes of age. And in your lead, you said how during 9 years ago when the parliamentary crisis occurred in Moscow and troops loyal to President Boris Yeltsin blockaded and then stormed the parliament building, Moscow TV had used CNN coverage.
That's true. But this time,
CNN used Moscow television coverage for the unfolding hostage crisis, as you put it. I wonder if you could tell us more about that.
Well, this is just a way to say what a long way Russian media has gone over the past years. And, of course, now the media effects of this crisis is one of the major topics discussed in Moscow. There are many questions that are being asked. My personal opinion is that overall, the media has done well. And, of course, there were many mistakes, and there is now tons of criticism against the media coming from political headquarters, from the special services. But overall, I think the particularly television and radio people who are very, very much in the middle of a situation like that, because with the hostage crisis, there is an ongoing thing, and the live reporting, which is seen by everybody, which is watched very, very attentively followed by people inside the theater. These are people who are actually, they can make an effect on the outcome. And I wouldn't say that people in the media were 100% ready for it. No. I've interviewed a lot of media executives in the past days, and they said, no, we did not have any plans how to cover things like this. It was very much done kind of on the spot in the development. Policies were developed right in the control room. But there were mistakes which we can discuss later. I don't know how much we should go into the detail, but still the overall performance has been rather good.
Let me move to Alexander then, Alexander Mekushev. Alexander, what is your assessment, and what about some of the mistakes that Andrei referred to?
Well, I agree that the Russian media, especially television, did very well in covering the hostage crisis, but there were also attempts on the part of the government and the presidential administration to guide the media, mostly television networks, into the correct kind of sort of coverage of the crisis. The Kremlin issued instructions to the media executives, telling them how to cover the crisis, what to show, what not to show. And after the crisis was over, President Putin said that we need to review our information policy in the view of how to cover the war in Chechnya and crisis situation like that. So I think that the media did very well, but there are still restrictions and there will be attempts to try and rein in the media to be more obedient, not so much to instruct, to show the facts and the situation, but also to follow the party line. So this is not a very good outcome of the crisis for the media.
For our listeners who are not as familiar perhaps with world geography as they might be, the Republic of Georgia borders Chechnya, and this is one of the reasons that we've asked Akaki to be part of our show tonight. Akaki, what was your assessment of the coverage from the Georgian point of view?
Well, unfortunately, I have to totally disagree with my Russian colleagues about the quality and success of the Russian media covering this crisis. And I have to underscore that this is not the fault of journalists at all, rather the government, because the pressure the government imposed on the media was comparable to the crisis in Chernobyl. Because, for example, Georgian media was able to report on the cases and topics and issues of this crisis more than Russian media. And in fact, we had reports from Moscow, from our colleagues, that they were not able to broadcast there at home. And thereby, Georgian viewers got better perspective of what is happening there than the Russian audience. And in fact, when you mentioned in the beginning that CNN was copying, rather, or assessing the situation based on the Russian media, that is true, too, because CNN coverage was very bad, too. It didn't reflect the whole situation. Especially, this refers to the next day of the anti-terrorist operation, which at large, the media and Russian media assessed as this as a big success. And I have also to touch one issue, which was that the government used, the Russian government used successfully local media to pursue its goals, for example, in relationship to the to its dispute with Georgian government. And first reports were saying that Georgian flags were waving from the building of theater, and that all the Georgian nationality viewers that were hostages were released right from the very first moment of the siege, which later turned out to be complete false. So the media, Russian media, played the game of the government, which actually didn't help to cover the situation in an unbiased manner, which is which media is supposed to do. So right. This is at large the, my assessment. But I want to in final underscore once again that this is not at large fault of journalists. Russian journalists are quite professional, very successful, linked to high standards of covering, but the governmental pressure perhaps was too high for them to resist it.
Well, the governmental pressure in these times, and in the face of terrorist acts is great, even here in the United States. And let me turn to Betsy Pisek. Surely the attention was great on this event at the United Nations, Betsy, and I wonder what your take is on this question.
Well, it wasn't really a UN story, but of course everything tends to overlap. I just wanted to say from a U.S. media perspective, what was fascinating about the story was that it was happening so far away. Given the time change, newspapers had a hard time replating, constantly updating information because things were happening at night. So by the time people woke up in the morning, the story had completely changed. We turned to radio, cable news, etc. And the other thing, at the risk of sounding cynical, that made this a very, well, it was a riveting story one way or the other, of course. But the thing also is that we have two main stories, at least last week, here in the United States. The first, of course, is the very divisive war with Iraq that's looming. And second of all, this sniper that was terrorizing Washington, D.C. and the suburbs, that got an enormous amount of interest here. And that was one man, as it happens, too, but one gun, one victim at a time. By comparison, and there was nothing to take pictures of. By comparison, the siege in Moscow was riveting. The way this overlaps at the UN were two questions. First, how would this impact on the Security Council discussions over Iraq, being that the United States and Russia are on opposite sides of the fence on this resolution that has nothing whatsoever to do with the siege in Moscow? And secondly, what was the chemical used, and does it conform with international conventions and standards on the use of chemicals or the use of weapons against civilians? As it happens, we've pretty much solved that. This drug is fentanyl, and it appears to be fentanyl, and it also appears not to be on the UN schedule of prescribed chemical weapons. So that if that is what it is and all it is, then that answers that.
Apparently, all but two of the civilian deaths were related to the gas that was injected into the auditorium or into the theater. Just before the security troops broke in. Is that correct?
Yes, that's what we hear.
Okay. Let me turn now to the potential fallout in terms of journalism coverage for the media. At the time of the crisis, there one radio station, Echo Muscovy, was warned by the media ministry about broadcasting statements by the Chechenian rebels. And one television station, Moscovia, was, according to our reports, shut down for a day because of accusations for promoting terrorism.
For several hours, actually.
Yes, for several hours, okay. And a newspaper, Rossiyskaya Gazeta, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
After publishing a photograph of one of the victims, was also reprimanded. The ministry has just also stated, however, that there will be no long-term penalties. What is going to be the, in your minds, the future of coverage of the continuing war in Chechnya as a result of all this? Let's hear first from Andrei and then Alexander.
Well, from what I know about the way the press ministry functioned during these days, was that it was very much in the middle. It was, in a way, worked as a buffer between the media and the Kremlin and the parliament, where calls for censorship were much harsher than the ones that were actually implemented. I think the general conclusion from this for the Russian journalistic community is that there is a need to develop very strict guidelines for its own behavior in order to be able to avoid being censored from the outside. And the funny thing is that Akaki and I were in Vienna just several days before this crisis unfolded at an international conference of the Committee on Radio and Television Policy, organized in part by Duke University, DeWitt Wallace Center for Communication and Journalism, where the recommendations to journalists on how to behave at the time of crisis, how to cover, were developed. And we know of many guidelines which exist in the international journalistical practice, such as BBC guidelines and others. So now people in the Russian media are speaking about the need to develop such guidelines within media companies, as well as maybe some people are saying that some general rules should be adopted by the journalistic community and media organizations. I'm a little skeptical about that one. But there is an understanding that if such guidelines are not developed, if the situation continues when, for example, on NTV television on the first night, the anchor in the live coverage asked a hostage who was speaking to him by mobile telephone to pass the telephone to one of the hostage takers. At the same time, the ORT television showed the musical's producer on the air saying that he had just been briefing the secret services on the plan of the building, and he pretty much repeated what the thing about the building. I mean, if things like that continue, then the government will be very harsh in censoring the media. In fact, the parliament is very much likely to pass very restrictive measures tomorrow as an amendment to the law on the media, which may have effect on the future coverage of the war in Chechnya because of the vagueness of the definitions which are there. And I'm not going to go into
Let's come back to that, Andrei. We need to take just a short break for our listeners now, and we'll be back. This is Global Journalist. We're back discussing the ramifications of the terrorist acts and the media response in Moscow. Before we move on, I want to remind our listeners that you can also listen to this show on the internet at www.globaljournalist.org or at www.kbia.org. Let's move on, and just before the break, Andrei, you were discussing the law which has passed, I believe, the lower house of the Duma, but is yet to go on to the upper house or to reach have President Putin's signature. This is
no, it's going to have a third reading tomorrow.
Third reading.
Duma. Yeah.
Now our reports, and perhaps we can also ask Alexander to comment on this. Is that this would prohibit the media from printing or broadcasting information that justifies, in the language that we have here, extremist activities in resistance to counter-terrorist operation or hinders counter-terrorist operations and reveals tactics. This is according to a statement released by the Committee to Protect Journalists here in the United States.
Well, Scotty,
yes.
I think that the future coverage of any crisis, and especially in Chechnya, will be determined by two factors. Number one is that public opinion in Russia has moved away from any support for the Chechen rebels or separatists fight for whatever ends, like independence or freedom from Russia or whatever. And secondly, the government, you know, television and journalism in general is more about access than the art of writing and producing stories. So I think that in the view of the crisis and the, hints that the press might have given to the terrorists about the operation that was underway, the government will try and limit access to specific areas in the country, to specific territories, to specific people, so it will be much more difficult for journalists to cover anything because they will just have no access to these facilities, to places, and so on. And I think that the government in general, especially in the light of the forthcoming presidential elections, parliamentary elections, you know, people in power would like to keep the status quo, so they will try to control television, which is the biggest source of news and information for the Russian people. I think that smaller newspapers will be allowed to operate freely, but the major national television channels will be under strict pressure from the government, from the Kremlin.
Lakaki, let's go back to the Georgian perspective here. Of course, we've had recently the disagreement as to the presence of Chechenian rebels in the Pankisi Gorge area, and the what we have seen from the west here is some real saber rattling between Russia and Georgia over the issue of this civil war. Could you expand on that for us?
Yes, that's right. The problem that you raised still exists, although it's almost solved because Chechens have already left the gorge. almost all of them. But media and local media particularly has been very successful in exposing it, exposing the problem. And returning back to the crisis in Moscow, I truly hope that the media coverage and the result, how media was able to expose all the facts, either in Moscow or in Pankisi Gorge, would show the governments in both countries that Soviet times have changed and there is no way that you can really contain information flow. There's no iron curtain in place. But based on what Andrei says, doesn't seem to be the case, and it looks like the governments are still pursuing their goal to hush down and hush the local media. But eventually this won't work, because as I told you, when Putin imposed censorship in Moscow on coverage the actual outcome of anti-terrorist operation, then Russian journalists were sending their reports to Georgia or to other republics, I guess, too. So we were able to broadcast those, and eventually public was able to know and find out what was happening really there. It's no longer Chernobyl situation.
Can you cite some examples of, excuse me, Akaki?
Sure.
May I have a question to Akaki?
Absolutely.
Akaki, what were, for example, the stories which were reported in Georgia, which were not reported in Russia?
Okay, I'm referring directly to the second day and third day situation after the anti-terrorist operation, when Russian media at large assessed the operation as success, and there was no mention about huge number of associated people, about the death cases in hostages, and things like that.
So you're speaking about Saturday and Sunday, yeah? Basically,
yes.
After the
directly
storm.
Directly after the operation.
But
later on. But later on, situation improved, because I guess it was obvious to the government that there was no way that they can actually lock the whole country and stop the information flow. I guess that was the reason.
Let me interrupt here. We need to get Betsy Pisek in here, because I think, Betsy, I don't know whether you agree with me, here in the United States, there was some confusion about the facts following the... after the takeover of the theater by the security forces.
Yeah, it was quite chaotic, and the fact that it happened halfway around the world in the in the middle of the night for us was quite a challenge. It's tough to report on unfolding events like this, and it's even harder when a lot of your people on the ground, your reporters, your correspondents, et cetera, don't speak the language and may not even be that closely grounded in the details and the background of the conflict. In a situation like this, there probably isn't much of an excuse for that, considering how long it took to unfold, and also the fact that it was a major urban center. But it's hard to know what's going on. And sometimes, especially under the crush of deadline, it's very difficult to know what to go with and how to use it.
And Betsy, weren't there also some press restrictions on the sniper story in Washington that you referred to earlier?
Yeah, it's interesting to me to compare those two cases, because any time you can slap the word terrorism on something, it instantly ratchets up the heat a little bit, and it's very tempting to do that. The U.S. government in this case got very quickly involved in the sniper in the hunt for the sniper. I mean, at one point there was a surveillance planes over the region trying to find what was thought to be a single gunman, and how to both inform readers, and don't forget too, in the area this was also a question of public safety. Where is this man operating, and what should you do, if anything at all, to protect yourself? By comparison, I think that there were not so much in the way of press restrictions. There were notes that were leaked and that sort of thing. But whether that hampered the investigation or in fact helped it is something that's still being discussed, because the man who phoned in the tip about the car where the gunmen were actually apprehended, was he'd seen the license plate broadcast on television, and he'd said, oh, well, that's the car. So, in fact, media involvement in that case might have helped. But it is difficult to know, even in a fairly clear-cut case, what you are dealing with. And so it's up to reporters to figure out how to present the most information that they can, but to do it in an accurate context. And sometimes that's hard.
I think it's the kind of pressure that is facing reporters worldwide. And it has curious admixtures with the fact that all of us are also citizens of the countries that that we represent. Let's get back then to the Moscow crisis. What's likely to be the result of the call for an ethical code among journalists in covering terrorism? Let me first ask Alexander.
Well, I think that Russian journalists have been trying to write an ethical code for a long time. But the problem is that in Russia, the press is so diverse, the press corps is so diverse. There are hundreds of journalists working for foreign media outlets. There are, leftist newspapers and magazines. There are right-wing organizations and their publications. There are rich and not so rich television networks. So all the journalists are very different. They have their own mandates. They have their own owners. They have their own affiliations. And I don't think it will be easy, if at all possible, to write an ethical code that will be acceptable to all.
I mentioned earlier that I was in Ulaanbaatar during this the crisis and spent a lot of time at the Press Institute there, and the journalists there were, you all I'm sure will not be surprised to know, were glued to the television sets and trying to figure out what would I do if I were in a similar situation. And again, I would have to agree with them that in general, the Russian journalists and the international journalists deserved high marks for this for their coverage, but the rules are changing, and I think it's going to be increasingly difficult. Mm-hmm. I'm also afraid that we're out of time, and I have to, there's a lot more that we could say, but for now I will just thank our panelist Kaki from the Republic of Georgia. Thank you for providing the mirror view of this coverage. Betsy from the United Nations and for the Washington Times for the American point of view. Alexander and Andre for the view of the international press and the Russian press in Moscow. At the Global Journalist for Pat Akers, our director and engineer, for our producer, Sarah Fajardo. And of course, Stuart Lurie will be back next week. I'm Byron Scott. Good evening.